In the privacy and what they consider the warmth of their houses, car hiders often go half-clothed or naked. On our journey, Estevan had lost all the smooth, compact solidity that marks the Gathenian physique. He was gaunt and scarred, and his face was burned by cold almost as by fire. He was a dark, hard, and yet elusive figure in the quick, restless light. Where to? South and west, I think. Towards the border. Our first job is to find you a radio transmitter strong enough to reach your ship. After that, I must find a hiding place, or else go back into Orgrun for a while to avoid bringing punishment on those who help us here. How will you get back into Orgrun? As I did before, cross the border. The Argata have nothing against me. Where will we find a transmitter? No nearer than Sassanoth. I winced. He grinned. Nothing closer. 150 miles or so. We've come farther over worse ground. There are roads all the way. People will take us in. We may get a lift on a power sledge. I assented, but I was depressed by the prospect of still another stage of our winter journey, and this one not towards Haven, but back to that damned border, where Estevan might go back into exile, leaving me alone. I brooded over it and finally said, there'll be one condition which Carhide must fulfill before it can join the Ecumen. Argivan must revoke your banishment. He said nothing but stood gazing at the fire. I mean it, I insisted. First things first. I thank you, Genry, he said. His voice, when he spoke very softly as now, did have much the timbre of a woman's voice, husky and unresonant. He looked at me gently, not smiling. But I haven't expected to see my home again for a long time now. I've been in exile for 20 years, you know. This is not so much different, this banishment. I look after myself. And you look after yourself and your Ecumen. That you must do alone. But all this is said too soon. Tell your ship to come down. When that's done, then I'll think beyond it. We stayed 2 more days in Kirkarest, getting well fed and rested, waiting for a road packer that was due in from the south and would give us a lift when it went back again. Our hosts got Estevan to tell him the whole tale of our crossing of the ice. He told it as only a person of an oral literature tradition can tell a story, so that it became a saga, full of traditional locutions and even episodes, yet exact and vivid, from the sulphurous fire and dark of the pass between Drumner and Dremagol to the screaming gusts from mountain gaps that swept the Bay of Guthin, with comic interludes, such as his fall into the crevasse, and mystical ones, when he spoke of the sounds and silences of the ice, of the shadowless weather, of the night's darkness. I listened as fascinated as all the rest, my gaze on my friend's dark face. We left Kirkarest riding elbow-jammed in the cab of a roadpacker, one of the big powered vehicles that rolls and packs down the snow on Carhidish roads, the main means of keeping roads open in winter, since to try to keep them plowed clear would take half the kingdom's time and money, and all traffic is on runners in the winter anyway. The packer ground along at 2 miles an hour and brought us into the next village south of Kirkarest long after nightfall. There, as always, we were welcomed, fed, and housed for the night. The next day we went on afoot. We were now landward of the coastal hills that take the brunt of the north wind off the Bay of Guthin, in a more heavily settled region, and so went not from camp to camp, but from hearth to hearth. A couple of times we did get a lift on a power sledge, once for 30 miles. The roads, despite frequent heavy snowfall, were hard-packed and well-marked. There was always food in our packs, put there by the last night's hosts. There was always a roof and a fire at the end of the day's going. Yet those 8 or 9 days of easy hiking and skiing through a hospitable land were the hardest and dreariest part of all our journey. Worse than the ascent of the glacier, worse than the last days of hunger, the saga was over. It belonged to the ice. We were very tired. We were going the wrong direction. There was no more joy in us. Sometimes you must go against the wheel's turn, Estevan said. He was as steady as ever, but in his walk, his voice, his bearing, vigor had been replaced by patience, and certainty by stubborn resolve. He was very silent, nor would he mind speak with me much. We came to Sasanoff, a town of several thousand, perched up on hills above the frozen E. Roofs white, walls gray, hills spotted black with forest and rock outcropping, fields and river white. Across the river, the disputed Sinoth Valley, all white. We came there all but empty-handed. Most of what remained of our travel equipment we had given away to various kindly hosts, and by now we had nothing but the chabi stove, our skis, and the clothes we wore. Thus unburdened, we made our way, asking directions a couple of times, not into the town, but to an outlying farm. It was a meager place, not part of a domain, but a single farm under the Sinoth Valley administration. When Estevan was a young secretary in that administration, he had been a friend of the owner, and in fact had bought this farm for him a year or two ago when he was helping people resettle east of the E, in hopes of obviating dispute over the ownership of the Sinoth Valley. The farmer himself opened his door to us, a stocky, soft-spoken man of about Estevan's age. His name was Thesiker. Estevan had come through this region with hood pulled up and forward to hide his face. He feared recognition here. He hardly needed to. It took a keen eye to see Harth Remyar Estevan in the thin, weather-worn tramp. Thesiker kept staring at him covertly, unable to believe that he was who he said he was. Thesiker took us in, and his hospitality was up to standard, though his means were small. But he was uncomfortable with us. He would rather not have had us. It was understandable. He risked the confiscation of his property by sheltering us. Since he owed that property to Estevan, and might by now have been as destitute as we if Estevan had not provided for him, it seemed not unjust to ask him to run some risk in return. My friend, however, asked his help not in repayment, but as a matter of friendship, counting not on Thesiker's obligation, but on his affection. And indeed, Thesiker thawed after his first alarm was past, and with Karhidish volatility became demonstrative and nostalgic, recalling old days and old acquaintances with Estevan beside the fire half the night. When Estevan asked him if he had any idea as to a hiding place, some deserted or isolated farm where a banished man might lie low for a month or two, in hopes of a revocation of his exile, Thesiker at once said, "Stay with me." Estevan's eyes lit up at that, but he demurred. And agreeing that he might not be safe so near Sasanoth, Thesiker promised to find him a hideout. It wouldn't be hard, he said, if Estevan would take a false name and hire out as a cook or farmhand, which would not be pleasant, perhaps, but certainly better than returning to Orgrin. What the devil would you do in Orgrin? What would you live on, eh? On the commensality, said my friend, with a trace of his otter smile. They provide all units with jobs, you know. No trouble. But I'd rather be in Karhide, if you really think it could be managed. We had kept the chabi stove, the only thing of value left to us. It served us, one way or another, right to the end of our journey. The morning after our arrival at Thesiker's farm, I took the stove and skied into town. Estevan, of course, did not come with me, but he had explained to me what to do, and it all went well. I sold the stove at the town commerce, then took the solid sum of money it had fetched up the hill to the little college of the trades where the radio station was housed, and bought 10 minutes of private transmission to private reception. All stations set aside a daily period of time for such shortwave transmissions. As most of them are sent by merchants to their overseas agents or customers in the archipelago, Sith or Parenter, the cost is rather high, but not unreasonable. Less, anyway, than the cost of a second-hand chabi stove. My 10 minutes were to be early in third hour, late afternoon. I did not want to be skiing back and forth from Thesiker's farm all day long, so I hung around Sasanoff and bought a large, good, cheap lunch at one of the hot shops. No doubt that Karhidish cooking was better than Argata. As I ate, I remembered Estevan's comment on that when I had asked him if he hated Orgrin. I remembered his voice last night saying with all mildness, "I'd rather be in Carhide." And I wondered, not for the first time, what patriotism is, what the love of country truly consists of, how that yearning loyalty that had shaken my friend's voice arises, and how so real a love can become, too often, so foolish and vile a bigotry. Where does it go wrong? After lunch, I wandered about Sassenach, the business of the town, the shops and markets and streets, lively despite snow flurries and zero temperature, seemed like a play, unreal, bewildering. I had not yet come altogether out of the solitude of the ice. I was uneasy among strangers, and constantly missed Estevan's presence beside me. I climbed the steep, snow-packed street in dusk to the college and was admitted, and shown how to operate the public-use transmitter. At the time appointed, I sent the wake signal to the relay satellite, which was in stationary orbit about 300 miles over South Carhide. It was there as insurance for just a situation as this, when my ansible was gone so that I could not ask Alul to signal the ship, and I had not time or equipment to make direct contact with the ship in solar orbit. The Sassenach's transmitter was more than adequate, but as the satellite was not equipped to respond except by sending to the ship, there was nothing to do but signal it and let it go at that. I could not know if the message had been received and relayed to the ship. I did not know if I had done right to send it. I had come to accept such uncertainties with a quiet heart. It had come on to snow hard, and I had to spend the night in town, not knowing the roads well enough to want to set off on them in the snow and dark. Having a bit of money still, I inquired for an inn, at which they insisted that I put up at the college. I had dinner with a lot of cheerful students and slept in one of the dormitories. I fell asleep with a pleasant sense of security, an assurance of Carhide's extraordinary and unfailing kindness to the stranger. I had landed in the right country in the first place, and now I was back. So I fell asleep, but I woke up very early and set off for Thesiker's farm before breakfast, having spent an uneasy night full of dreams and wakenings. The rising sun, small and cold in a bright sky, sent shadows westward from every break and hummock in the snow. The road lay all streaked with dark and bright. No one moved in all the snowy fields, but away off on the road a small figure came toward me with the flying, gliding gait of the skier. Long before I could see the face, I knew it for Estevan. "What's up, Ferrum?" "I've got to get to the border," he said, not even stopping as we met. He was already out of breath. I turned, and we both went west, I hard put to keep up with him. Where the road turned to enter Sassenach, he left it, skiing out across the unfenced fields. We crossed the frozen E, a mile or so north of town. The banks were steep, and at the end of the climb we both had to stop and rest. We were not in condition for this kind of race.
"What happened? Thesiger?"
"Yes. Heard him on his wireless set. At daybreak." Estevan's chest rose and fell in gasps as it had when he lay on the ice beside the blue crevasse. "Tibby must have a price on my head." "The damned ungrateful traitor," I said, stammering, not meaning Tibby, but Thesiger, whose betrayal was of a friend. "He is that," said Estevan, "but I ask too much of him. Strained a small spirit too far. Listen, Genry, go back to Sassenach."
"I'll at least see you over the border, Theram. There may be Argot guards there.
I'll stay on this side. For God's sake..." He smiled. Still breathing very hard, he got up and went on, and I went with him. We skied through small frosty woods and over the hillocks and fields of the disputed valley. There was no hiding, no skulking. A sunlit sky, a white world, and we, two strokes of shadow on it, fleeing. Uneven ground hid the border from us till we were less than an eighth of a mile from it. Then we suddenly saw it plain, marked with a fence, only a couple of feet of the poles showing above the snow, the pole tops painted red. There were no guards to be seen on the Argata side. On the near side there were ski tracks, and southward several small figures moving. "There are guards on this side. You'll have to wait till dark, Theram."
Tibby's inspectors, he gasped bitterly, and swung aside. We shot back over the little rise we had just topped and took the nearest cover. There we spent the whole long day, in a dell among the thick-growing hemmon trees, their reddish boughs bent low around us by loads of snow. We debated many plans of moving north or south along the border to get out of this particularly troubled zone, of trying to get up into the hills east of Sassanoth, even of going back up north into the empty country. But each plan had to be vetoed. Estevan's presence had been betrayed, and we could not travel in Carhide openly as we had been doing. Nor could we travel secretly for any distance at all. We had no tent, no food, and not much strength. There was nothing for it but the straight dash over the border. No way was open but one. We huddled in the dark hollow under dark trees in the snow. We lay right together for warmth. Around midday, Estevan dozed off for a while, but I was too hungry and too cold for sleep. I lay there beside my friend in a sort of stupor, trying to remember the words he had quoted to me once. Two are one, life and death, lying together. It was a little like being inside the tent up on the ice, but without shelter, without food, without rest. Nothing left but our companionship, and that soon to end. The sky hazed over during the afternoon, and the temperature began to drop. Even in the windless hollow it became too cold to sit motionless. We had to move about, and still around sunset I was taken by fits of shuddering, like those I had experienced in the prison truck crossing Orgrin. The darkness seemed to take forever coming on. In the late blue twilight we left the dell and went creeping behind trees and bushes, over the hill, till we could make out the line of the border fence, a few dim dots along the pallid snow. No lights, nothing moving, no sound. Away off in the southwest shone the yellow glimmer of a small town, some tiny commensal village of Orgrin, where Estevan could go with his unacceptable identification papers and be assured at least of a night's lodging in the commensal jail, or perhaps on the nearest commensal voluntary farm. All at once there, at that last moment, no sooner, I realized what my selfishness and Estevan's silence had kept from me, where he was going and what he was getting into. I said, "Theram, wait!" But he was off, downhill, a magnificent fast skier, and this time not holding back for me. He shot away on a long, quick, curving descent through the shadows over the snow. He ran from me and straight into the guns of the border guards. I think they shouted warnings or orders to halt, and a light sprang up somewhere, but I'm not sure. In any case, he did not stop but flashed on towards the fence, and they shot him down before he reached it. They did not use the sonic stunners but the foray gun, the ancient weapon that fires a set of metal fragments in a burst. They shot to kill him. He was dying when I got to him, sprawled and twisted away from his skis that stuck up out of the snow, his chest half shot away. I took his head in my arms and spoke to him, but he never answered me. Only in a way he answered my love for him, crying out through the silent wreck and tumult of his mind as consciousness lapsed, in the unspoken tongue, once, clearly, "Arik." Then no more. I held him, crouching there in the snow, while he died. They let me do that. Then they made me get up and took me off one way, and him another. I going to prison, and he into the dark. Chapter 20. A Fool's Errand. Somewhere in the notes Estevan wrote during our trek across the Gobrin ice, he wonders why his companion is ashamed to cry. I could have told him even then that it was not shame so much as fear. Now I went on through the Sinoth Valley, through the evening of his death, into the cold country that lies beyond fear. There I found you can weep all you like, but there's no good in it. I was taken back to Sassanoth and imprisoned, because I had been in the company of an outlaw, and probably because they did not know what else to do with me. From the start, even before official orders came from Erenrang, they treated me well. My Karhaidish jail was a furnished room in the Tower of the Lords Elect in Sassanoth. I had a fireplace, a radio, and 5 large meals daily. It was not comfortable. The bed was hard, the covers thin, the floor bare, the air cold, like any room in Karhide. But they sent in a physician in whose hands and voice was a more enduring, a more profitable comfort than any I ever found in Orgeron. After he came, I think the door was left unlocked. I recall it standing open, and myself wishing it were shut, because of the chill draft of air from the hall. But I had not the strength, the courage, to get off my bed and shut my prison door. The physician, a grave, maternal young fellow, told me with an air of peaceable certainty, "You have been underfed and overtaxed for 5 or 6 months. You have spent yourself. There's nothing more to spend. Lie down. Rest. Lie down like the rivers frozen in the valleys in winter. Lie still. Wait." But when I slept, I was always in the truck, huddling together with the others, all of us stinking, shivering, naked, squeezed together for warmth, all but one. One lay by himself against the barred door, the cold one, with a mouthful of clotted blood. He was the traitor. He had gone on by himself, deserting us, deserting me. I would wake up full of rage, a feeble, shaky rage that turned into feeble tears. I must have been rather ill, for I remember some of the effects of high fever, and the physician stayed with me one night or perhaps more. I can't recall those nights, but I do remember saying to him, and hearing the querulous, keening note in my own voice, "He could have stopped. He saw the guards. He ran right into the guns." The young physician said nothing for a while. "You're not saying that he killed himself?" "Perhaps." "That's a bitter thing to say of a friend, and I will not believe it of Harth Ramir Estravan." I had not had in mind when I spoke the contemptibility of suicide to these people. It is not to them, as to us, an option. It is the abdication from option, the act of betrayal itself. To a Karhider reading our canons, the crime of Judas lies not in his betrayal of Christ, but in the act that, sealing despair, denies the chance of forgiveness, change, life, his suicide. "Then you don't call him Estravan the traitor?" "Nor ever did. There are many who never heeded the accusations against him, Mr. I." But I was unable to see any solace in that, and only cried out in the same torment, "Then why did they shoot him? Why is he dead?" To this he made no answer, there being none. I was never formally interrogated. They asked how I had got out of Pullifen Farm and into Karhide, and they asked the destination and intent of the code message I had sent on their radio. I told them. That information went straight to Erenrang, to the king. The matter of the ship was apparently held secret, but the news of my escape from an Argata prison, my journey over the ice in winter, my presence in Sassanoth, was freely reported and discussed. Estravan's part in this was not mentioned on the radio, nor was his death. Yet it was known. Secrecy in Karhide is to an extraordinary extent a matter of discretion, of an agreed, understood silence, an omission of questions, yet not an omission of answers. The bulletin spoke only of the envoy, Mr. I. But everybody knew that it was Harth Ramir Estravan who had stolen me from the hands of the Argata and come with me over the ice to Karhide to give the staring lie to the commensal's tale of my sudden death from Horm fever in Mishnori last autumn. Estravan had predicted the effects of my return fairly accurately. He had erred mainly in underestimating them. Because of the alien who lay ill, not acting, not caring, in a room of Sassanoth, 2 governments fell within 10 days. To say that an Argata government fell means, of course, only that one group of commensals replaced another group of commensals in the controlling offices of the 33. Some shadows got shorter and some longer, as they say in Carhide. The Sarf faction that had sent me off to Pulliphen hung on, despite the not unprecedented embarrassment of being caught lying, until Argovan's public announcement of the imminent arrival of the starship in Carhide. That day, Obsol's party, the Open Trade faction, took over the presiding offices of the 33. So, I was of some service to them, after all. In Carhide, the fall of a government is most likely to mean the disgrace and replacement of a prime minister, along with a reshuffling of the Kyuremi. Although assassination, abdication, and insurrection are all frequent alternatives. Tibby made no effort to hang on. My current value in the game of international Shifgrathor, plus my vindication, by implication, of Estrovan, gave me, as it were, a prestige weight so clearly surpassing his that he resigned, as I later learned, even before the Erenrang government knew that I had radioed to my ship. He acted on the tip-off from Thesiger, waited only until he got word of Estrovan's death, and then resigned. He had his defeat and his revenge for it all in one. Once Argovan was fully informed, he sent me a summons, a request to come at once to Erenrang, and along with it a liberal allowance for expenses. The city of Sassenoth, with equal liberality, sent their young physician along with me, for I was not in very good shape yet. We made the trip in power sledges. I remember only parts of it. It was smooth and unhurried, with long halts waiting for packers to clear the road, and long nights spent at inns. It could only have taken 2 or 3 days, but it seemed a long trip, and I can't recall much of it till the moment when we came through the northern gates of Erenrang into the deep streets full of snow and shadow. I felt then that my heart hardened somewhat, and my mind cleared. I had been all in pieces, disintegrated. Now, though tired from the easy journey, I found some strength left whole in me. Strength of habit, most likely, for here at last was a place I knew, a city I had lived in, worked in, for over a year. I knew the streets, the towers, the somber courts and ways and facades of the palace. I knew my job here. Therefore, for the first time, it came plainly to me that my friend being dead, I must accomplish the thing he died for. I must set the keystone in the arch. At the palace gates, the order was for me to proceed to one of the guest houses within the palace walls. It was the round tower dwelling, which signaled a high degree of Shifgrathor in the court, not so much the king's favor as his recognition of a status already high. Ambassadors from friendly powers were usually lodged there. It was a good sign. To get to it, however, we had to pass by the corner red dwelling, and I looked in the narrow arched gateway at the bare tree over the pool, gray with ice, and the house that still stood empty. At the door of the round tower, I was met by a person in white yeb and crimson shirt, with a silver chain over his shoulders. Fax, the foreteller of Otherhord fastness. At sight of his kind and handsome face, the first known face that I had seen for many days, a rush of relief softened my mood of strained resolution. When Fax took my hands in the rare Carhidish greeting and welcomed me as his friend, I could make some response to his warmth. He had been sent to the Kyuremi from his district South Rur early in the autumn. Election of council members from the indwellers of Hundara fastnesses is not uncommon. It is, however, not common for a weaver to accept office, and I believe Fax would have refused if he had not been much concerned by Tibby's government and the direction in which it was leading the country. So he had taken off the weaver's gold chain and put on the counselor's silver one. And he had not spent long in making his mark, for he had been since Thurn a member of the Hes Kyuremi, or inner council, which serves as counterweight to the prime minister, and it was the king who had named him to that position. He was perhaps on his way up to the eminence from which Estrovan, less than a year ago, had fallen. Political careers in Carhide are abrupt, precipitous. In the round tower, a cold, pompous little house, Fax and I talked at some length before I had to see anyone else or make any formal statement or appearance. He asked with his clear gaze on me, "There's a ship coming, then, coming down to Earth. A larger ship than the one you came to Horden Island on 3 years ago. Is that right?" "Yes. That is, I sent a message that should prepare it to come." "When will it come?" When I realized that I did not even know what day of the month it was, I began to realize how badly off I had in fact been lately. I had to count back to the day before Estrovan's death. When I found that the ship, if it had been at minimum distance, would already be in planetary orbit awaiting some word from me, I had another shock. "I must communicate with the ship. They'll want instructions. Where does the king want them to come down? It should be an uninhabited area, fairly large. I must get to a transmitter." Everything was arranged expeditiously with ease. The endless convolutions and frustrations of my previous dealings with the Erenron government were melted away like ice pack in a flooding river. The wheel turned. Next day, I was to have an audience with the king. It had taken Estrovan 6 months to arrange my first audience. It had taken the rest of his life to arrange this second one. I was too tired to be apprehensive this time, and there were things on my mind that outweighed self-consciousness. I went down the long red hall under the dusty banners and stood before the dais with its three great hearths where three bright fires cracked and sparkled. The king sat by the central fireplace, hunched up on a carven stool by the table. "Sit down, Mr. I." I sat down across the hearth from Argovan and saw his face in the light of the flames. He looked unwell and old. He looked like a woman who has lost her baby, like a man who has lost his son. "Well, Mr. I, so your ship's going to land." "It will land in Aston Fen, as you requested, sir. They should bring it down this evening at the beginning of third hour." "What if they miss the place? Will they burn everything up?" "They'll follow a radio beam straight in. That's all been arranged. They won't miss." "And how many of them are there? 11? Is that right?" "Yes. Not enough to be afraid of, my lord." Argovan's hands twitched in an unfinished gesture. "I am no longer afraid of you, Mr. I. I'm glad of that. You've served me well. But I am not your servant." "I know it," he said indifferently. He stared at the fire, chewing the inside of his lip. "My Ansible transmitter is in the hands of the Sarf and Mishnori, presumably. However, when the ship comes down, it will have an Ansible aboard. I will have thenceforth, if acceptable to you, the position of envoy plenipotentiary of the Ecumen, and will be empowered to discuss and sign a treaty of alliance with Karhide. All this can be confirmed with Hine and the various stabilities by Ansible." "Very well." I said no more, for he was not giving me his whole attention. He moved a log in the fire with his boot toe so that a few red sparks crackled up from it. "Why the devil did he cheat me?" he demanded in his high, strident voice, and for the first time looked straight at me. "Who?" I said, sending back his stare. "Estrovan." "He saw to it that you didn't cheat yourself. He got me out of sight when you began to favor a faction unfriendly to me. He brought me back to you when my return would in itself persuade you to receive the mission of the Ecumen and the credit for it. Why did he never say anything about this larger ship to me?" "Because he didn't know about it. I never spoke to anyone of it until I went to Orgrin." "And a fine lot you chose to blab to there, you two. He tried to get the Orgata to receive your mission. He was working with their open traders all along. You'll tell me that was not betrayal?" "It was not. He knew that whichever nation first made alliance with the Ecumen, the other would follow soon. As it will. As Sith and Perenter and the Archipelago will also follow, until you find unity." "He loved his country very dearly, sir. But he did not serve it or you. He served the master I serve." "The Ecumen?" said Argovan, startled. "No.
Mankind. As I spoke, I did not know if what I said was true. True in part, an aspect of the truth. It would be no less true to say that Estevan's acts had risen out of pure personal loyalty, a sense of responsibility and friendship towards one single human being, myself. Nor would that be the whole truth. The king made no reply. His somber, pouched, furrowed face was turned again to the fire. "Why did you call to this ship of yours before you notified me of your return to Carhide?" "To force your hand, sir. A message to you would also have reached Lord Tibby, who might have handed me over to the Argata, or had me shot, as he had my friend shot." The king said nothing. "My own survival doesn't matter all that much, but I have, and had then, a duty towards Geffen and the Ecumen, a task to fulfill. I signaled the ship first to ensure myself some chance of fulfilling it. That was Estevan's counsel, and it was right. Well, it was not wrong. At any rate, they'll land here. We shall be the first. And they're all like you, eh? All perverts, always in Kemmer? Queer lot to vie for the honor of receiving. Tell Lord Gorchern, the Chamberlain, how they expect to be received. See to it that there's no offense or omission. They'll be lodged in the palace, wherever you think suitable. I wish to show them honor. You've done me a couple of good turns, Mr. I. Made liars of the commensals, and then fools. And presently allies, my lord." "I know," he said shrilly, "but Carhide first. Carhide first." I nodded. After some silence, he said, "How was it, that pull across the ice?" "Not easy. Estevan would be a good man to pull with on a crazy trek like that. He was tough as iron and never lost his temper. I'm sorry he's dead." I found no reply. "I'll receive your countrymen in audience tomorrow afternoon at second hour. Is there more needs saying now?" "My lord, will you revoke the order of exile on Estevan to clear his name?" "Not yet, Mr. I. Don't rush it. Anything more?" "No more." "Go on, then." Even I betrayed him. I had said I would not bring the ship down till his banishment was ended, his name cleared. I could not throw away what he had died for by insisting on the condition. It would not bring him out of this exile. The rest of that day went in arranging with Lord Gorchern and others for the reception and lodging of the ship's company. At second hour, we set out by power sledge to Aston Fen, about 30 miles northeast of Erenrang. The landing site was at the near edge of the great desolate region, a peat marsh too boggy to be farmed or settled, and now in mid-Irum a flat frozen waste many feet deep in snow. The radio beacon had been functioning all day, and they had received confirmation signals from the ship. On the screens coming in, the crew must have seen the Terminator lying clear across the great continent along the border from Guthan Bay to the Gulf of Charsoon, and the peaks of Kargov still in sunlight, a chain of stars, for it was twilight when we, looking up, saw the one star descending. She came down in a roar and glory, and the steam went roaring up white as her stabilizers went down in the great lake of water and mud created by the retro. Down underneath the bog there was permafrost like granite, and she came to rest balanced neatly, and sat cooling over the quickly refreezing lake, a great, delicate fish, balanced on its tail, dark silver, in the twilight of winter. Beside me, facts of other hordes spoke for the first time since the sound and splendor of the ship's descent. "I'm glad I've lived to see this," he said. So Estevan had said when he looked at the ice, at death. So he should have said this night. To get away from the bitter regret that beset me, I started to walk forward over the snow towards the ship. She was frosted already by the inter-hull coolants, and as I approached, the high port slid open, and the exit way was extruded, a graceful curve down onto the ice. The first off was Long Heo Hu, unchanged, of course, precisely as I had last seen her 3 years ago in my life and a couple of weeks in hers. She looked at me and at Fax, and at the others of the escort who had followed me, and stopped at the foot of the ramp. She said solemnly in Karhaidish, "I have come in friendship." To her eyes, we were all aliens. I let Fax greet her first. He indicated me to her, and she came and took my right hand in the fashion of my people, looking into my face. "Oh, Genli," she said, "I didn't know you." It was strange to hear a woman's voice after so long. The others came out of the ship on my advice. Evidence of any mistrust at this point would humiliate the Karhaidish escort, impugning their Shifgrathor. Out they came, and met the Karhaiders with a beautiful curtsy. But they all looked strange to me, men and women, well as I knew them. Their voices sounded strange, too deep, too shrill. They were like a troop of great strange animals of two different species. Great apes with intelligent eyes, all of them in Rut, in Kemmer. They took my hand, touched me, held me. I managed to keep myself in control and to tell Heo Hu and Tullia what they most urgently needed to know about the situation they had entered during the sledge ride back to Erenrang. When we got to the palace, however, I had to get to my room at once. The physician from Sassanoth came in. His quiet voice and his face, a young, serious face, not a man's face and not a woman's, a human face. These were a relief to me. Familiar, right.